This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're live from the Museum of Natural Sciences in downtown Raleigh. And because we're visible, we're also live streaming. And so you can watch us at this very moment at stateofthings.org and watch our radio show. Well, and I understand that you are eating your lunch right now, but I just have to tell you about this 4-pound rat. No. Generally, we think of all rats as kind of creepy pests that hang out in alleys and carry disease. But in Tanzania, the African giant pouched rat is saving lives. These rats are able to sniff out landmines and detect tuberculosis in patients. And so far, the rats have been relatively under-researched. Danielle Lee is going to fix that. She is currently exploring the biology and the behavior of the African giant pouched rat. Danielle Lee is, of course, best known as the urban scientist. She's a biologist, an animal behavioral scientist, and completing her postdoctoral research at Cornell University. She's in Raleigh now to give a talk tonight at the Museum of Natural Sciences about the giant African pouched rat. I can't say it enough, but Danielle, it's great to have you here. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Please tell us more about this animal. It's a wild animal, right?
It is a very common species throughout sub-Saharan Africa. And we've recently learned there are many other subspecies names, or actually species names. For a long time, it's also been called the Gambian pouch rat. So it's part of a group of Chrysidomes. And this particular species I study in Tanzania is Chrysidomes and Sorgii. But before, we were calling it Gambiana. So it's been some reorganization of it. But it's an awesome rat. It's really large. It is an R-O-U-S. R-O-U-S from Princess Bride, rodents of unusual size.
There you go. And they really do, like, they're about 3 feet long, and they're about four pounds, maybe?
Yes, they are. So, and I trap and catch them in the wild, and they can get up to 80 centimeters long, which is about 2.5 feet. And that includes the tail. But half of that is body. So a good-sized rat is about the length of your laptop computer.
Now, what is their reputation when they're not helping? We're going to talk a little bit about what they do, but what's their reputation?
They're crop invaders. Uh-huh. So they're called pouch rats because they have cheek pouches like hamsters. So they spend the evening above ground harvesting corn and grain and palm kernels. And according to local ecological knowledge, they'll steal things like your clothes and other little things off the line, and so they'll collect them and cash them. The cache, cash.
So they're
and
pack
collect
rats.
Them. Yeah, so they what we would call pack rat behavior, and they make their nest and they interact and do things like that. But they're nest invade or they get into your home, so they're mostly a pest. Other than when they're being trained to save lives.
And they find you because they have a powerful sense of smell, which is the good thing.
That is an awesome thing about them. Some very recent research looked at their olfactory bulb, and it finds that just their brain is just filled with all this great neural connections between their nose and their brain. So it makes them at least very wired to do really good olfactory detection.
So whose idea was it first to have them detect landmines?
So this was actually a part of the brainchild of the nonprofit that trains them called APOPO. It's out of Belgium. And the story of the founding of the organization is that the founder raised rats as a child. So it was his favorite pet. And he lived in Africa for some time, and his wife is from Africa, and he knew that landmines were a problem. So much land has been lost, agriculture land, living land, wildlife land, and he wanted a way to restore this land to people. And he thought, rats are very trainable. He liked them as pets, and he thought, what if we can find a way to train rats? And because this rat is so common, and so they're always there, what if we can find a way to train this local, rat to help, reclaim land in its own land, to help, the local ecology.
So how did it work? Tell us a little bit about that initial training, and how effective are they?
So the rats have been certified by the United Nations. I don't have all the details because I don't actually work for the nonprofit that does it. But initially, it was trial and error, figuring things out, figuring what works. But simple operant conditioning, the same techniques that are used to train dogs. So dogs that are bomb, sniffing dogs, same techniques. It takes a little while. It takes up to about a year to train a rat, but they work with rats that have been born in captivity. So wild rats are not very good for training because they're wild rats. But you can breed them and then start working with their babies. And it seems like your ability to handle them is important because they are in contact with human trainers a lot. And they use clicker training. Clicker training, when they do something that's and reward them, and then they give them treats, banana and mashed up peanuts, And that's their reward treat. When they find, they're initially taught on fields, and it's a progression of steps. They learn how to detect TNT, or now in this case, they're training them for tuberculosis. And they're still being certified for that, but I've seen the early training of that. It is impressive what these rats can do. They're able to eliminate at least negative samples much quickly.
Really?
Yes. So they line it up along a strip, and they use the spitum in sample, and what would happen naturally under a microscope is you have a tech and they have to look at one sample and scan it and scan it and scan it, and it could take hours. Well, you can line up to 10 vials in front of a rat on a runway, and he or she runs down the tube, and if they smell the indicator smell, they just stop in front of it. And they found so far that it at least helps eliminate negatives, so not to waste researcher time looking through all those samples.
Where are they in the process? Because I know if you get a TB test, all you're testing for is exposure, but you may not have TB, right?
Right. So where they are in the research process is still they're validating.
Okay.
They're validating how effective these rats are. So they're still not used as the only method. They're comparing them to that. But I've seen the early training. These rats are phenomenal because they can test 10 samples in less than a minute.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And all of this came about because somebody had kind of a personal contact. So that's the other interesting
thing.
That
is the other interesting thing. And I'm still not absolutely sure of all of that story, but that's what you see on the website. That's what you can get.
Hey, that's our story.
But that's the story of it.
Yeah.
But I know the trainers. I've interacted very closely with the trainers.
Now tell us about your part in this as somebody who's very interested in the behavior of animals.
So my part is I'm interested in learning more about their basic behavior and natural history. So my research is actually funded by the Department of Defense. And so it's part of a basic research grant to just learn more about this animal. Because they have this amazing potential for detection, both for biological purposes and for safety purposes, just want to know more about them. Could it be feasible for us to look into this in the future? But the first things first, we got to know more about the animal itself if we're going to be responsible for them and using them to our benefit. And that's what I'm doing. I'm helping to decipher the basic biology because we actually there's not a lot of written record on it. We're not sure the mating system. We're not sure how old animals are when they become sexually mature. What's their social organization? What are their behavior inclinations? And so I do two-part study. I work in the field, so I spend about 3 months a year in Africa trapping them, tagging them, following them in the wild. And then I spend the rest of the time here in the States studying them in the lab, doing behavior tests, the same old regular behavior tests you learn in psychology class, so the mazes and the open field rooms. And I'm just trying to understand their basic reactions to different environments and to individuals when they get reintroduced. Really basic stuff. But knowing that little simple stuff helps us be able to decipher, how might they interact with the conspecific before mating? Are they competitive with one another? How social are they? Before we do any breeding, we want to make sure we don't want to risk anyone fighting and ripping each other's heads off. And so we'll eventually be doing breeding. So we have to understand their breeding behavior. I'm interested in individual differences, and that's where the individual tests like the open field and the mazes come in. As we learn more about their behavior, the perspective is, can we learn enough about them to be able to identify which animals may or may not be perfect for training? We like to streamline it because, like I said, it takes up to a year to train them. It'd be awesome to streamline this.
You get it done a little faster. Is there any, and I guess the thing we should point out, too, is that when they're detecting landmines, dogs can do this, but dogs are heavier. So
absolutely. Rats are lighter. That is the first thing. They don't set the landmines off. And care is taken to help to protect the dogs as well. Keep that in mind in that training. But the rats are just naturally lighter. The other thing that makes the rat more ideal than the dog is, well, two things. They're cheaper to take care of as far as how they eat and what they eat and the amount of space to raise them. They also don't personally attach to their trainer. Dogs do. Dogs, for the most part, do. So it's they're very much a team. That dog and that trainer are a team, and they work together in concert. The rats, for the most part, don't attach to any particular trainer.
That's interesting. I mean, dogs certainly have evolved much closer. Dogs and humans, co-evolved and not so much.
So it's a lot more flexibility on the work site.
You call yourself the urban scientist, particularly in your blog. What does that mean? Talk about your mission as
an
urban scientist.
So I was born and raised in Memphis, Tennessee. So I grew up in the inner city. I loved it. And I spent a lot of time outside watching animals and watching nature. And I like to talk about the fact that even though I get to go to exotic places, I didn't know that's what I was going to end up doing all along. And so I like to spend time focusing on the biology in your backyard and encouraging other people to see that there's plenty of biology, there's plenty of wild kingdom adventures right in your neighborhood park and right in your backyard. And so that's what I started doing, because until recently I lived in a big city.
Well, you know, and this museum in collaboration with NC State has a big, backyard biology.
Yes.
And you can find it. I don't have the website here, but you can find it, and it's a lot of fun, and you can all participate.
Yes.
Well, when did you decide that science was for you and you were going to make it a career?
Career-wise, it wasn't until I was about 2 years into my master's.
Master's in what, then?
A master's in biology.
Okay.
So I wasn't even a degree candidate. I was just taking classes because I wanted to be a veterinarian, and I was trying to strengthen my transcript to get into vet school. And I was taking a class, and a paper I wrote, the professor's like, I like this idea you wrote about. I think you can turn it into a project. And so he designed the experiment, and I spent the summer doing research. And he was like, if you're working doing the work, get a thesis. You know, earn the thesis. It gives you more options. I decided to do it, and I realized I love research. And what turned me on was I was always interested in animal behavior. In my classes, I would always ask professors, well, why are those animals doing this? Why are those animals doing that? And I never got an answer that was all the way sufficient. And I realized through my graduate program, I was truly learning what the scientific method was. Mm. And that was the first time I no longer needed anyone to answer those questions for me, because they had equipped me with the skill set to answer my own questions.
And I know that you make it part of your mission to encourage people of color to get into the sciences, right?
Absolutely. And let me just say this. People of color are already into the sciences. It's about the labeling and owning that the activities that they participate already are naturally connected to science. So I really do want to deliberately have this conversation about underrepresented communities being served more with science communication, with very authentic and upfront opportunities to do science. So, yes, I really do care about letting other little girls like me know that I didn't have to look for vet school to find a career. I could have been fast-tracked into animal behavior if I'd known that this was a realistic career.
You made this point recently at the White House, right?
I did.
Tell us about it.
I was at the White House as a part of the Champions of Change commemoration, and the theme of the week is STEM, so science, technology, engineering, and math. And I was one of 10 honorees for our work and effort in STEM access and diversity.
What has to be done? You talked about just telling, you know, letting everybody know that they're probably already involved, that there's a way to fast track. What do we have to do? What would have to change to make that an easier idea for everybody?
Part of it is about, so diversity is important. Diversity means having different people at the table. But the real key to keeping people in science is about inclusion. It's about truly making a space for everyone and letting them know that they're welcome just as they are to participate in science. And that includes being able to communicate in culturally relevant ways, to talk with various audiences in culturally relevant ways, and just making it very accessible to people by meeting them where they are. And not, I mean, yes, coming to these great institutions are perfect, but we can find ways to partner to actually go into those communities to really leave more than breadcrumbs. We really need to leave something permanent, like good stepping stones and good pathways between multiple communities and these institutions of science discovery.
You've also acknowledged that there is a degree of mistrust of science in communities of color as well.
Absolutely. And that's historically, I mean, that's just on our system of America. You know, we have, you know, different groups that have been in power and others that have not. There have been some groups that have been the labor and they have been exploited. And we know in science research that groups of color, particularly African Americans and Native Americans and Chicanos, have been exploited. They've been used as the bodies, the guinea pigs, and not so much as the actual researchers to have some stake, particularly when it comes to ethical issues and being respected and listened to. And that only gets better when those of us who have a foot in both of those communities are able to represent both of our communities and translate and communicate and wedge that door open and, you know, help those of us who, from the communities of color, the underserved communities, have true access to science.
back to the subject of your research, you said you were frustrated that you couldn't always get the answer, and now you're doing some research on this particular animal. What have you found? What have you learned about?
The question answer is, we still don't know.
It's because I said so. That's why they do it. Well, I trained them to do it, and so it's because I said so.
Well, I actually don't train. I'm not a trainer. I am a ethologist. I'm all about the natural history of the animal. What they show me is what they show me. The question is getting them to show me because they live underground, so they tend to be secretive. They're nocturnal. So it's been challenging. And a lot of this depends on having the right toys to get the information. But I've learned so far that I tend to find females more than males. I've learned some amazing, interesting things that are still a mystery about their reproductive biology. Like, until a female is of a certain size, she doesn't seem to have a vagina.
Regardless of her age?
No. Well, that's it. We don't know how to age them. That's how little we know. I just know what I catch. They don't give me birth certificates when they come above ground.
Keep up the good work, Danielle. And you're going to be here tonight, and you're going to be talking all about this, right?
I'll be talking all about the research, showing lots of great pictures of Tanzania.
All right. Well, that's fantastic. Danielle Steele Lee. Did I just call you Danielle Steele?
You did.
She makes more money than both of us, you know.
You know what? I wouldn't mind being her dependent.
Danielle Lee is an urban scientist. She is an animal behavioral scientist. She's completing her postdoc research at Cornell, and she's going to be here tonight at the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh talking about giant African pouched rats tonight, 7 o'clock, Museum of Natural Sciences. For more information, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. And that's our program for today. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.